We will move on. Last time I was offering kind of some summary comments on this dual active bridge. A lot of these higher level, not specific theory that I'm going to expect you to apply, but just giving you some information that I want you to have for kind of understanding of how this thing operates, some examples. The main conclusion I want you to take from this is that in these zero voltage switching converters, even though we've done this nice thing, we've created a method of operation where we can get rid of a lot, and depending on gate drive design, maybe a dominant portion of our switching losses, we still do pay a price for that. Okay? So if I want to have ZVS over the full range, I need the large inductance. That ends up making my RMS currents larger, and as a result, my conduction losses go up. So it's not a free lunch. It's not a, my currents stay the same and suddenly my switching losses are gone. So I'm getting rid of switching but increasing conduction, and that's going to change kind of the trade-offs of how I design my converter. Okay. So now when I go to select devices, I'm soft switching. I prefer a very low on-resistance device because now conduction losses dominate, but they are, for the same device, going to be worse than the non-soft switching case. Okay. So there's this trade-off back and forth. And as we go to, if we just have conduction losses left, you think, okay, I want to select the device with the smallest on resistance. That'll give me the lowest losses, right? Because I only have conduction losses. But the trade-off is when I select a low on resistance device, that's a big die. That's a bunch of small FETs in parallel on the die. That big die is going to have a very large capacitance. And that very large capacitance increases my RMS current. In fact, I don't want the largest possible device, even though it is only conduction losses, because my conduction losses now depend on what were previously switching characteristics, this capacitance. Okay. Does that make sense? There is still an optimum in terms of device selection, not just pushed all the way out, and I want a, one nano-ohm device the size of a hockey puck. Actually, would get horrible RMS currents down there. Then we talked about briefly methods for extending the ZVS range, both adding a magnetizing inductance to add some ramping current and altering the conversion ratio, either by changing what our output voltage is or by changing the turns ratio. Okay. And I'll show a couple more slides here giving examples of that. So just to show some experimental results from some prior work, here's the dual active bridge converter. This is that transformer. Lost my pen. Moment, please. Lost my projector. Okay. Sorry about that. We're back. Electric bridge converter. The transformer is here. Primary side devices here. Secondary. This is a 150 to 12 volt, 1 megahertz, 120 watt prototype. Some experimental waveforms at 100 watts here. You see the inductor current has this nice near square wave shape that we've talked about. When the conversion ratio is close to the turns ratio, kind of flat currents, and I have decreased current stresses, These are the drain to source of the low side devices on my primary. These nice resonant transitions up achieving zero voltage switching. The drain to source on my secondary, one of the low side devices, see is that the switching transition is very steep and there's this ringing afterwards. Okay? And that's the nature of this converter stepping down from 150 to 12. Like I mentioned briefly before, so on my 150 volt side for 120 watts, I've got less than an amp. A very low current charging a capacitor over a very large voltage. On the secondary, 12 volts, 120 watts, I've got more than 10 amps. I've got 10 amps charging a capacitor just to 12 volts. That happens very quickly. In fact, on the secondary, I may even prefer not to have zero voltage switching in favor of reducing the current during that switching instant. What I mean is that for the secondary sets, because the current pulse is so large, voltage is low, so the energy stored in this capacitor is small, but there's some parasitic drain inductance, both due to the FET itself and due to layout. And with this very large current pulse, the energy in that inductance can actually be more significant than the energy in the output capacitor. Okay. So the ringing and the spike you're seeing there is due to that drain inductance. At high voltage and low current, doesn't matter at all. When you start going to low voltages, high currents, that becomes more significant. If you look at things like power supplies for computer processors that are an output of 1 volt, 100 amps, 0 volt switching, nobody cares about. 1 volt, 1/2 C times 1 squared is no energy at all. But the current during that shutoff that goes through this small drain inductance, 100 amps, is now a much more significant loss mechanism. We haven't put a lot of emphasis on it in the course. We talked about zero current switching early in the course as opposed to zero voltage switching. Said that's a good thing for diodes and IGBTs that have reverse recovery and current tailing. It's actually still useful in MOSFETs in this extreme case where you're very high current, very low voltage. You might go towards the zero current switching case. Okay. Here, just a comparison, the state plane, M sub P, J sub L, showing the analytical solution that we've covered in class, and then experimental results showing they match pretty well. There's a little bit of ringing, but it tracks this method of analysis. Here, I just wanted to grab some slides showing this effect that I talked about before. So if I change my conversion ratio, either by adjusting a voltage or a turns ratio so that V over NVG not equal to 1. Here I'm showing by just decreasing the output voltage. What happens is for the same power, here I have the same average output current, my wave shape changes and I get this ramping during the power delivery interval. What that gives me is higher current during the time where I am switching my primary. Okay. Here I'm showing two cases where they're both zero voltage switching. This one just happened faster because there's more current. But I could also use this to extend. If I had a case where nominally I didn't have VVS, I can add a little bit extra current, maybe get up to J peak is equal to 2 and get my VVS. This plot that we had drawn last time, showing the ZVS range versus the conversion ratio. Here's just a more formalized solution to that. So on the left, I've got for this design output power versus M sub N. M sub N was just this V over NVG. This region here is full ZVS of all devices. And I can keep that down to some power, roughly 80 watts. Be my Pmin ZVS below 80 watts. No matter what I do with conversion ratio, I'm going to lose zero voltage switching. But I can kind of choose up here, I'm losing it on the primary. Down here on the secondary, like I was arguing just a moment ago, I definitely prefer to not have VVS on the primary because it's high voltage, a lot more energy in those gaps. I'd rather have it on the secondary where it's not really benefiting me any. Over here, these are contours of efficiency. For this design, what you see is that if I kind of looked at these boundaries here, if I start going up into primary hard switching, I rapidly decrease from 97% efficient down to 80% efficient. If I start going down into secondary hard switching, my efficiency decreases much slower. And of course, as I get down to zero power, my efficiency goes to zero, no matter what converter, what topology. Zero power out, zero efficiency. Okay. So it's advantageous to kind of go down in this trajectory. This is divided out partial hard switching. Partial hard switching would be if I have enough energy to resonate up some of the way, looking at my primary side voltage, resonate up, can't quite get to zero voltage switching, switch at the minimum voltage across the set. Then way out here would be full hard switching, where I'm switching the full DC bus voltage. This is an animation I had that I thought might be useful to see the effect. So these are the same axes, the conversion ratio versus output power, conversion ratio of 1 here. This is my state plane, M sub P, J sub L. This is just the meter showing what kind of output power I'm looking at. I'm starting at full. And then the time domain, inductor current and primary side voltage. And it's an animation. I'm going to let it run in a second here, and it's going to trace out what the waveforms look like if I decrease the output power down to somewhere where I have hard switching, and then decrease conversion ratio to gain soft switching back on the primary. We'll just look at how the waveforms change, I hope. Maybe we won't. That's the plan anyway. There we go. Well, one thing works at a time. We love being a professor of electrical engineering, standing up here struggling with computer issues. I know some things. Oh, it's up there. Okay. So as the output power is decreasing, you see I hit this point where I start hard switching. You can see it on the state plane and my VP. I just don't have enough energy to get full soft switching. So I continue decreasing output power. It gets worse and worse. And here, I begin increasing. I have this greater ramping. Now I have more current available to come back and regain soft switching. As I go even further, my state plane just extends. I have even more current, and I'm well above my ZVS constraint. I have a lot of current, and I can get very fast soft switching, lots of energy left in the inductor. Okay. So that kind of points towards the idea of maybe there is some trajectory I could trace, something like this, that would allow me to maintain ZVS for that primary. I'd lose it on the secondary, but that's preferable on the low voltage side. Another reference here taken from this group at the ETH in Zurich. They designed a 2 kilowatt converter for automotive applications, the bidirectional dual active bridge, going from 240 to 450 down to a lead acid battery, nominally 12, 11 to 16 volts. found a similar thing, even though they're able to maintain ZVS over a lot of the range on the low voltage side, there's significant switching losses left due to that parasitic inductance. In this case, even more emphasized with 2 kilowatts down at 12 volts of something like 200 amps, a little bit less. Their dominant loss mechanism is still a switching loss, but it's related to this inductance rather than a capacitance. They looked at alternate modulation schemes. So this is the phase shift modulation that we've been looking at. In this case, with V not equal to NVG, which we can see in the ramping of the inductor current, but the voltages, what they call VT1 and VT2, are still 50% duty cycle square waves, and they're just phase shifted to control the power. Okay. Some of these alternate modulation schemes allow not only plus and minus VG. Let's see, where do I have a DAB schematic? So we looked at either this FET and this FET on, or this FET and this FET on, which gave us voltages VP could be VG or minus VG. Same thing on the output bridge, but I have additional states. I can turn on Q2 and Q4 or Q1 and Q3. Both pairs equivalently will just create a short across the primary and give me 0 volts, roughly. Okay. So in general, I have 3 possible voltages I can apply on the primary, on the secondary, plus and minus V and 0. And then depending on how I use each of those 3 states on the primary and secondary, I can generate different wave shapes. These are examples of certain types of what's called triangular modulation. The advantage of it is I can ramp up to a high peak current, high enough for my ZVS, and then quickly ramp down, keeping my average power low for the same peak current. Okay, this is when I want to operate at low power but maintain ZVS. With phase shift modulation, what we looked at before, when I drop below some power, I lose ZVS. This is kind of going in the opposite direction of what we talked about for full power. Now I really want high peak currents, even though that's going to increase conduction losses some, but it allows me to have enough current for ZVS while operating at low power. Right? If I use traditional phase shift, this would flatten out. My average output current would be much larger. And in order to get down to a lower current, I'd have to operate with phase shift modulation somewhere like this. And that wouldn't be enough peak current for ZVS. The alternate modulation scheme lets me extend my ZVS range. Yes. It's all for it based on the operating point. So it's now a quantity to be regulated. And in general, whether it's equal to NVG or not, if I have some resistive load, right, my voltage depends on how I operate the converter. We're not into a section of the course where I've concerned the lectures much with dynamics yet, but if I look at the base operation of this converter, see, for example, here, what I'm doing by controlling VG and the time that V out is applied is I'm controlling the wave shape of this inductor current, right? And my output current is rectified according to the state of the output bridge. So really, by adjusting the timing of this, I'm controlling the output current. And at my output, I've got some cap and some load. The output voltage is going to be dictated by at what voltage is the current in equal to the current out. Okay. So, you know, when I solved and said V is equal to NVG, neglected the load and just said the load is whatever it needs to be so that these waveforms I'm assuming are true and such that V is equal to NVG. But if I change the load, this converter would then steady out at a higher voltage. V would not be equal to NVG. Okay. So it's a bit backwards. I can solve this converter with some assumed voltages, some assumed timing, figure out what the output current is, and then tell you what the load would need to have been so that those waveforms stay valid. I can do that across all operating points and then just invert my solution and say, okay, for these loads, here's the timing to get this output voltage. Does that make sense? Okay, some results of this work using this additional modulation scheme, they're able to maintain high efficiency across all different voltage conversion ratios and across the full range of power. Okay, last thing I want to talk about on this dual active bridge is transformer saturation. And this is a problem in the dual active bridge. If I look at from the secondary here, I have some magnetizing inductance to this transformer. And if I try to control this thing to generate VS waveforms that look like VS versus time, something like this, that voltage is applied directly to my magnetizing inductance. Okay? And on paper, it's real easy to say make this zero DC, but in reality, we probably have some DC component of this. So I can look at the total volt seconds, lambda, just integral of voltage over time, applied in the positive half and applied in the negative half. And almost certainly in any real implementation, lambda 1 is not equal to lambda 2. And this happens because my timing of the gate drive signals is not exactly perfect to the femtosecond scale and below. My switching times of the devices may vary a little bit device to device by manufacturer variability or temperature. On resistances may change, which slightly changes the voltage. But somehow there's a little bit of difference here. And I don't have exactly zero DC in this waveform. Because that's applied directly to the magnetizing inductance, that means is that average of VS over one switching period is not equal to zero. So the average voltage applied to LM is not equal to zero. I have some DC component applied to my magnetizing inductance. We mentioned the magnetizing inductance a couple times. It should have a waveform that looks like this. But if I add in some DC component on the voltage, it's going to have a waveform that looks like this. And this is going to continue on until my transformer saturates and I get huge spikes of current and my whole thing blows up. Okay. So this needs to be addressed in some way in the dual active bridge. One option is to sense currents on both the primary and secondary and look for some DC components in my current going in or coming out of the transformer. We cannot sense magnetizing current directly. We can add a third coil to the transformer and try to get information on the magnetization that way, which is really equivalent to sensing currents anyway. There are other methods for kind of using secondary sensing, looking at voltage ripples elsewhere in the converter to see if this effect is going on. The dominant way to do it and the most simple is to put in a big DC blocking cap in series with the transformer, likely on both sides, prevent saturation from either side. This is, I'm writing it as C infinity. What I mean by that is it's just some big value, as big as it needs to be so that it can block any DC voltage. It won't let DC current flow through, but to anything AC of interest, it looks like a short. Okay. For that to work, I really need is now I've got some resonance here between C infinity and LL. I want the frequency of that resonance to be way below the switching frequency so that I get some 0.1% of a resonant period over one switching period, and I don't even see it at all in the operation of this converter. Okay. That makes sense. Okay. So next thing we're going to look at, all right, what if I violate that design rule? So very similar, but a fundamentally different in terms of mechanism of operation converter is this series resonant converter. And I changed the schematic at the last minute for those of you with the printed notes to be something that looks closer to what we had, but fundamentally no different from what was in there. But the idea is this looks just like now what my dual active bridge was if I have this DC blocking cap. The only difference is now 1 over root LR CR approximately equal to my switching frequency. What I'm going to do is let this tank resonate at the switching frequency. My waveforms then are going to look like, depending on how I design it, my VAB might be something like this. My IL not good. Something like this. Okay. So we're going to dig into the next section, the operation of this converter, and analyze it in the state plane. Before we do that, I'm going to take the remainder of this lecture and kind of jump topics here and talk about magnetics losses. Okay. This is something that I have not traditionally put any emphasis on in this course, but with the design competition, that I'm going to talk about more on Monday, I think we all need a kind of base level of understanding of magnetics design in order to build a converter. The magnetics losses are going to be a critical component of your design selection. Okay. So we're going to jump through some of this fairly quickly. Looking at losses in magnetics, at DC, we have the conduction losses of an inductor or a transformer, any winding. They're given by a DC resistance, which is rho, the resistivity of copper, repeated here for reference, times the length over the area. I have some wire, my cross-sectional area, and then this would be LB. Okay. And if I just put DC current in it, my losses are I squared times RDC. As I start going up to high frequency, we're talking about in this class, I have a couple effects which need to be considered. First, skin effect. So as my current going through the conductor has some significant AC component, that current inside the conductor generates a flux. And that flux then in turn generates these eddy currents in this kind of direction. Those eddy currents tend to oppose my main current flowing through the conductor, and what they end up causing the skin effect, where if I, kind of shown in this diagram, if I look at the cross section of my conductor, in here, the eddy currents cancel out the main current. Here, my current is approximately zero. And then whatever current I was putting has to flow all in this region. Okay. So I have kind of this dead copper in the middle. In reality, the profile of the current, this kind of exponential over on the sides, we generally approximate that with the skin depth parameter delta, which is an equivalent distance of copper where I could say all of this current flows within a delta of the edge of the conductor. Okay. So what that's going to do is it's going to increase my resistance, right? Here, my resistance depended on the area that the current was flowing through, and this is effectively decreasing my area. And solve for what the AC resistance looks like. This distance here is delta. Then I have a effective area of the wire at AC, which looks like the total area of the wire minus this area where there's zero current. That's going to look like, and let's call this area pi times the radius of the wire squared. My area here is going to be that. Minus this inner area with zero current. Okay. And if I then plug that in to my equation for resistance, what I get is that RAC is rho times length over effective area at whatever frequency the AC current is flowing. If I plug that in and kind of simplify here, get as RAC is rho LB over I, my RW squares will cancel, get 2 delta RW minus delta squared. That would be 2 RW minus delta times delta. Yeah. So this will be my AC resistance as a function of this skin depth and the original area of my wire. Skin depth, delta, given by this equation here. Resistivity of the material, given for copper. Permeability, which is roughly mu naught for copper, and it's proportional to 1 over the square root of frequency. Okay. And this chart from the book, our book, shows what the penetration depth is for a range of frequencies, and over here, what wire gauge corresponds to that skin depth, where my RW is equal to delta approximately. So I still have, under this approximation of all the current flows within one delta of the surface, I still have full utilization of the copper. You see, as we go out of here to 1 megahertz, we're getting below 40 gauge, which is tiny wire, talking about strands of hair now. So this is going to be a problem in our higher frequency converters. Looking at calculating losses, taking into account skin depth, shown here, my dashed line would be my RAC as a function of frequency. And then these arrows, I'm showing the spectrum of some arbitrary periodic wave shape of current. So I have, for example, I of t looks like a square wave with the DC offset. Then I would have IDC as my DC component. Then this would be my I1 Fourier series expansion of that at the switching frequency, and then I3, I5, I7, my odd harmonics. Okay. So at DC, I have a DC resistance seen by my DC current. As I go up in frequency, I have a larger resistance seen by these harmonics, but my harmonics are diminishing, right? So I have a big switching frequency component, and then everything's dropping off. It's the square wave as 1 over n, where n is the harmonic number. Okay. So just plugging in a numerical example, here I used, again, I changed a little bit from what I posted to make the numbers a little better. AWG 40, 1 amp DC with 1 amp peak to peak, 1 amp peak, square wave current. One meter long coil, 1 megahertz is my switching frequency. I think that's all we need to know. So at the top, I'm looking at the spectrum of the current normalized by the DC component. So this would be my FS, and I go up to 21 FS. You see my harmonics dying off. 1 megahertz, 3 megahertz, 5 megahertz. Then my AC resistance, calculated as we just showed, is this is increasing as 1 over root F. And this down here is my power if I multiply the square of that current times the resistance at that frequency. See is that even though the resistance keeps going up, the harmonics are dropping, so I have a lot of power here at the fundamental, and then diminishing power out of these harmonics. Okay. So if I'm designing an inductor in a high frequency converter, or a transformer for that matter, I need to consider how accurate I need to be in this calculation. Okay. If I really want to know exact losses, I need to take the full spectrum of currents and the full relationship, the frequency dependence of R, calculate all the power. If I do my analysis and this is about 5% of my total loss, and this is less than 1% of my total loss, I don't care about the rest of this. Okay? Maybe don't care about that one either, depending on how accurate I want to be. But likely, I at least need to look at the resistance at my switching frequency and the component of my current at my switching frequency and consider this loss beyond just the DC resistance of my windings. If I get a design and this is 50% of my total loss, one, I may want to reconsider my design right away, right? But if I really I'm in love with this design, I want to stick with it, I probably do need to go out and calculate the rest of these. This may be another 5% hit in my total losses. Okay. And generally, that's something that's up to you to decide what's significant enough to bother calculating. Proximity effect is discussed in the book in some detail in section 13.4. Here, I just want to say this effect exists in multi-layer windings of inductor or transformer, where I have layer one would be many windings comprising a layer all with the same current. Layer two, same thing, all current into the page. This layer generates a flux like this. That flux then induces eddy currents in this side of layer two, shown down here. Here's the flux. These are induced eddy currents. So here's a pair. I have current going into the page, current coming out of the page. This is just the circulating current. Then this one, current just coming out, that's my current I want going through the winding. So for each of these are all series windings. I want the current of I going through them. But in this layer, I get the circulating current plus my current external to the inductor. And the effect multiplies as I go up in layers because these eddy currents cause their own flux, which induce additional eddy currents in the next layer. So if I have a multi-layer winding, my power losses begin to scale. Second layer, I have 5 times the losses in the first layer. Keep going, 9 times the losses in the third layer. Don't quote me on that math, but it scales up very quickly. Okay. So when I'm looking at high frequency, this is an effect that happens when skin depth is significant, when the width of the winding is much greater than the skin depth. So at high frequency, this is going to be a problem. We showed the skin depth. If I'm at a megahertz, I can't just use 40 gauge wires. They're too small. I'm going to have some skin depth going on. I want to avoid multi-layer windings in my design. Okay. For transformers, this effect can be mitigated by interleaving. So doing my layers instead of primary, 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 secondary, 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 and primary, secondary, primary, secondary, primary, secondary. That opposite direction current cancels out the flux and brings me back down to zero flux in between my windings. Okay. An example showing frequency-dependent losses in a magnetic component. This is a transformer. I use 30-gauge copper wire. Skin depth of that occurs for the size I specified at around 50 kilohertz. The one-to-one transformer, these green windings, I could call my primary. They all have current going into the page. White windings are my secondary. They all have current coming out of the page. And this is a slice through the window of the component. To make this an actual magnetic component, I would have windings like this, kind of revolve this whole thing 360 degrees. Okay. So I'm going to look at where the flux flows on a scale, blue smallest flux density, pink largest flux density. And over here on the right, I'm going to look at current density in the winding, and blue to red. Actual number is not so important, but what I want to look at is the distribution. So first, if I have a kilohertz, an amp in each winding, my current density, these all just look like solid green. They're all equally distributed average current throughout the conductors. And my flux kind of flows through a path here, multiplied up because the flux from all three primaries kind of goes through the center here, from all three secondaries, then cancels it back down. So I have essentially zero flux density here and here. And it ramps up in the middle of this coil. As I go up in frequency to 100 kilohertz, the copper losses increase by almost a factor of 2. And it may be a little bit difficult to see on this screen, but I start to see just a little bit of unequal current distribution kind of in here. There's a little bit higher current on the inner edges of these inner windings, but things are still pretty even out towards the outermost winding. If I go up to 1 megahertz, the situation becomes a lot worse. Now I can see significant skin and proximity effect going on. See the current density very high in my 2 inner windings, where I should have the worst proximity effect. And even on my outer windings, it's all flowing around the edges. Looking at my flux, it is now kind of selectively avoiding the conductors themselves. That's because it's now at a high enough frequency that the conductors are generating internal eddy currents to cancel out flux through them. The lower frequency, conductors were too small, they couldn't generate eddy currents large enough to cancel that frequency. At 10 megahertz, I'm dominated. I have copper loss that's 65 times larger for the same current than I did at 1 kilohertz. I have huge currents flowing around the outer side, lots of skin and proximity effect. The flux is now completely canceled in the conductors themselves by eddy current. Mentioned, this is all run with a tool called FEMM, which is a free tool that plugs into MATLAB. You can download. It's got a bit of a learning curve, but it's a very useful tool. It's a finite element tool for solving magnetics. So basically, it just solves Maxwell's equations at a mesh grid of this geometric structure that I draw, solves Maxwell's equation in each element, and gives me the answer. Last thing as far as winding losses is fringing. This one is difficult to do much in terms of equations with, but easy to understand conceptually. If the flux from these adjacent windings was causing extra current due to this proximity effect, so I have whatever the flux is generated by one eye of current causing losses in this next adjacent conductor, then the flux from all of these windings is coming through the core. So if I put windings next to an air gap in the core, I now have the flux from all the windings going through here. Any conductors adjacent to this winding are going to be hit with a very high magnitude of flux, and they're going to have resulting eddy currents that cause more losses. So generally, when I'm winding this, when I'm selecting where to put my conductors in my magnetic winding window, I want to stay heck away from this air gap, because any conductors close to the air gap, this is some design where I need an air gap. It's not an ideal transformer. It's an inductor or a flyback transformer. At that air gap, the flux fringes out, and if it hits conductors, it will cause additional eddy current losses. An example of that, using the same tool, this was an inductor design that had a very large air gap. What I had is four windings in parallel. And this was a two-turn inductor. So these windings would come out and connect to these, go down, then the second turn here. Put four in parallel because it was high current and I wanted as much copper area as I could have. When I simulated this, I got 330 watts of loss in this thing on that high current. It was a lot. And you can see that here, there is very high current density near the gap. It's going fully pink here, whereas the windings down here and up at the top, maybe kind of more in this range, blue to green. Resimulated just removing those windings entirely. So now I just have two in parallel. So I've doubled my DC resistance. But here, because I had high current and it was fully AC, my loss is about roughly two-thirds, somewhere between two-thirds and half the loss. So even though I've used now a smaller area and my DC resistance has doubled, by getting those conductors out of that fringing flux area, I've reduced all those eddy current losses, gotten the net benefit in conduction losses. So that is winding loss, core loss. I'm going to have to get into on Monday. We'll finish up core loss, and then we will talk about moving into the design competition on Monday. Thanks, guys.